which of course applies to our very today's day and age, where the ruling class or the rich are considered special people, or they're given special privileges, or they aren't, you know, equal in front of a court of law, they can get away with anything. But here Imam Ali shows us that no, all men, all people, all of humanity is created equal before Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. Truly a profound lesson brought to us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تبقى عيني بدمع مشتاقيا قد لسعت حية الهوى كبدي فلا تبيب لها ولا راغي
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, about the personality of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
تمام ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به اسلام چه به عنوان انسان مؤمن به هر دینی
human in general whether a muslim non-muslim or even a disbeliever respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib this means Ali ibn Abi Talib is a global character who is respected by Sunnis, Shias, and even non-Muslims. Everyone, even the faithless people, respect Imam Ali and his personal values.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridvi.
Today I would like to focus on examples from non-Muslims who admire the sermons of Amir al-Mu'mineen, especially when it comes to Nahj al-Balagha. And we are talking about the non-Muslims of the present day. Sulaiman Qattani wrote a book in the 60s. And see what he has to say about Ali and the words of Ali. He says, 14 centuries with their hours, days and years have dissolved like the grain of salt dissolves in the palm of the ocean. Yet not a letter of your great name has dissolved. The words which have come from your lips have constantly refused for 14 centuries to be limited to time or place, because they carry from you the light of true values of thought and struggles for the reality of life. They cannot be confined to any one framework. And then, you know, he has his way of explaining the struggles of Amir al-Mu'mineen. And there is one point very interesting where he says, as a non-Muslim, studying the life of Ali, he says, is it correct, my Lord, that instead of making frequent visits to you, men disagreed about you. And he knows, you know, history, there was a division among Muslims about him. And then he says, some of them have lost you and have not found you. Some of them have lost you and then found you. And some of them have found you and have then lost you. It is indeed incredible. This is what how, you know, he ends with it. And this is where we have to realize, you know, inshallah, we will not ever be among those who found Ali and then lost him. And this can only happen, you know, if we really get in touch with the spirit of the wisdom that Amir al-Mu'minin has given to us. And so this was an Arab Christian writer. He's speaking about the wisdom of Amir al-Mu'minin Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu wa salam. Today I would like to focus on one or two examples from non-Muslims who admire the sermons of Amir al-Mu'minin, especially when it comes to Nahj al-Balagha. And we are talking about the non-Muslims of the present day. Another contemporary religious writer from the West by the name of Thomas Clary. He's actually expert in linguistics. He has a PhD in Eastern Asian languages. And he specializes in translating religious texts from Eastern religions, mostly focusing on Buddhism and other religions of the East Asia. But he also has, you know, worked in Arabic and in Quran. And he also actually looked at Nahj al-Balagha and he was impressed with it. And he selected some sayings from that book and translated it in English and published it. It's a small, you know, booklet with a very interesting and appealing title. You can actually find it in other major, you know, bookstores, especially in U.S., where this was published in Boston in 1996. The title he gives to that book, Selected Sayings of Amir al-Mu'minin, he says, Living and Dying with Grace, Counsels of Hazrat Ali. What a beautiful name. That your life and your death, if you want it to be with grace, then you have to look at the wordings and the sayings of Amir al-Mu'minin Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu wasalam.
Dear listeners, we hope you enjoyed this episode of To My Brother. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. We leave you in Allah's care. Bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
As ulum sharifi islami.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Jafar Sobhani. Please stay tuned.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على خير خلقه وآله الطاهرين.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Praise be to Allah, the Lord of the worlds, and may His peace and blessings be upon the best of His creation, Prophet Muhammad, and His pure progeny. The master of the pious, Imam Ali alayhi salam, has divided people into three categories. People are either scholars or students. Also, the third group is comprised of those who are ever ready to respond to every call. They are like mosquitoes being swept away with the wind. They fly in the direction of the wind without anything like self-will. Such type of people, instead of trying to making their capabilities blossom, put a lid on their intelligence and waste it away. These people always look around for the wings of others to fly with. They are ignorant of the fact that in this world of creation, no two individuals are born with exactly equal capabilities in every field. No one can be equal to any other person in every respect, be it a matter of appearance, feeling, or likes and dislikes. The lines on the palms of one man are always different from those of all others. When the situation is such, it is very unwise on our part to bind our thinking with the thoughts of others and not to take benefits of the individual God-given abilities, faculties, and proficiencies. Great people always tread their own new path. They have walked on ways which others did not tread before. They have gifted new presence to humanity. Such great people have throughout their lives been innovators, giving birth to new ideas, sciences, and industries. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Jafar Sobhani. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care, and goodbye.
In the limelight.
The U.S. Center for Budget and Policy Priorities estimated that it would take at least $2 trillion to provide $400 per week unemployment benefit, food and housing aid, and state and local government aid without taking into account funds for virus testing and other pandemic-related efforts. Many American economists estimate it may take $3 trillion to $4 trillion to help the economy recover. Josh Bivens, the director of research at the left-leaning Economic Policy Institute, argued that the path to recovery would take years and far more funding than is being discussed for the next round of relief. We now present you an article written by Igor Derish, a New York-based political writer whose work has appeared in the Los Angeles Times, Chicago Tribune, Boston Herald, and the Baltimore Sun. The piece is titled, Economists Say U.S. Needs 400% More COVID Relief Than McConnell Is Offering. Please stay with us for more of Igor Derish's article. Economists say the next coronavirus stimulus bill needs to be at least four times larger than the U.S. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's $500 billion proposal. Congress remains deadlocked on a bill after Mitch McConnell repeatedly rejected the $3.4 trillion HEROES Act passed by the House back in May, and the $2.2 trillion compromise offer House Democrats approved recently. McConnell said recently that a bill dramatically larger than his $500 billion proposal is not a place I think we're willing to go. Yet economists say the country needs at least $2 trillion to help the economy recover back to where it was before the pandemic, just as the U.S. enters the worst wave of the coronavirus pandemic yet. Mitch McConnell's delays threaten to worsen the issue that the stimulus bill is supposed to relieve. Joseph Stiglitz, a Nobel Prize-winning economist and Columbia University professor, told Salon.com, "The delay in providing the stimulus almost surely will increase the amount of money necessary to restore the economy." Stiglitz added, "Balance sheets of households and firms get eroded, and firms go bankrupt. Digging yourself out of a deep hole is much more expensive than preventing a decline into a deep hole." Another instance in which the aphorism, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, is applicable. The rise in coronavirus infections in recent weeks has compounded the problem. The number of new confirmed cases in the country topped 150,000 for the first time on Thursday, 12th of November. Though the true number is likely far higher, since positivity rates in certain states suggest testing is missing a massive number of cases. Michael Gretz, a former senior Treasury Department official and co-author of The Wolf at the Door, The Menace of Economic Insecurity and How to Fight It, argued the issue should not be a matter of cost, but an issue of need. Michael Gretz, who is now a professor at Columbia University, said, "Small businesses are closing around the country, and despite many reopenings, there is still more people unemployed than at any point since the Great Depression of the 1930s. So we need to do what we did in the CARES Act. That includes additional loans and grants to keep businesses open, enough money to provide at least $300 to $400 per week in federal unemployment benefit, funding to help struggling hospitals, another round of $1,200 checks to help people pay their rent, and funding to help state and local governments that have run out of money." He estimated all of those measures add up to close to $2 trillion. Michael Gretz said, "You're talking about serious problems that need to be addressed." He added, "It's like going shopping for your children when school starts. You don't ask how much I'm going to spend, you ask what do they need." Gretz argued that the government must get the economy through the next 6 months until there is an effective vaccine that is widely distributed. That view is shared by a large number of economists. The left-leaning Center for Budget and Policy Priorities estimated that it would take at least $2 trillion to provide $400 per week unemployment benefit, food and housing aid, and state and local government aid, without taking into account funds for virus testing and other pandemic-related efforts. Other economists estimate it may take as much as $3 trillion to $4 trillion to help the economy recover. Josh Bivens, the director of research at the left-leaning Economic Policy Institute, argued that the path to economic recovery would take years and far more funding than is being discussed for the next round of pandemic relief. He told Salon.com restoring the unemployment rate to 3.5% it was before the pandemic would require about $800 billion per year in stimulus funding, totaling between $1.5 trillion to $2 trillion. If it was for very effective stimulus measures like federal unemployment benefit and state and local aid. He said, "Then, however, we can't just turn it off like a spigot, because that would be a big fiscal cliff." He added that it would take another $400 billion per year over several years to slowly manage the transition of demand being stimulus-led from private sector-led. He estimated aiming towards an even lower unemployment rate would require at least another $100 billion per year over several years. A major impasse in negotiations has been over the size of the unemployment benefit. U.S. Democrats have been steadfast in their demand to keep $600 per week federal boost that was included in the CARES Act, whilst Republicans are pushing for a figure closer to $300 to $400 per week. Republicans have argued that the higher number is a disincentive to workers to return to their jobs, even though studies have repeatedly found that the generous federal boost had no impact on the labor market. EPI's research estimated over the summer that reducing the unemployment benefit to $400 per week would shrink the economy and cost millions of jobs. Marco Gretz argues that with so many months passing since the benefits expired, Democrats should cave and agree to a lower figure in the interest of getting the money out sooner to the people who need it most. He said, "I think they should agree to do less in order to get the money out of the door. Every week that passes, that is $400 less that people who are unemployed have." He added, "Their households are at stake. If you can't get $600, you have to accept $400. Another impasse has been over aid to cash-strapped cities and states. Tax revenue for local government dried up amid the shutdowns, and the damage is only expected to get worse as the country enters what is expected to be a devastating winter. While Democrats have sought a $1 trillion package for aid to city and state government, Mitch McConnell has deemed the proposal a blue state bailout. He suggested earlier this year that the country should let states go bankrupt, which is illegal, and pushed to exclude any new money for states in his September proposal. Michael Goretz said that failing to save struggling cities and states would absolutely worsen the problem by resulting in more layoffs. Goretz added, "We're looking at 6 more months at least of state and local government not getting the revenues that they need to function." He added, "I don't understand why Congress, which has the ability to provide the money, has decided that it would like to see this as an occasion for layoffs of public workers. There's this myth that the state and local government can balance their budgets if they just cut out fraud, waste and abuse. But instead, they're going to cut out teachers, policemen and firemen." Michael Gretz pointed out that whilst mostly Democratic-led states were hit hardest in the spring, the areas where hospitals are now filling up are in Republican states. He said, Republican governors need money as much as the Democratic governors do. He added, this is not a red state-blue state divide when it comes to addressing this problem. Gretz said, the human costs are just enormous, adding, I think this is an emergency. The government needs to respond to emergencies. It claimed that it's responded to the suspicious 9/11 events. The scope of this is far greater than the damage of 9/11, and it needs to respond. We spend $10 trillion fighting wars in West Asia in response to 9/11. We need to spend what we need to spend now. Josh Bivens urged lawmakers to consider other long-term implications of coronavirus relief measures. He said, these cost estimates are basically things laser-focused on normalizing unemployment. He added, we need a lot more than that to have a generally decent society that provides broad-based economic security. Bivens said those measures include deeper social insurance, including working to de-link health insurance and jobs, as well as investment in early childhood care and care work, and regulations and rules that empower workers to get a bigger piece of the pie. He added, the pre-COVID low unemployment rate basically disguised just how rotted our economy had become in its potential to deliver genuine security for all. But it's impossible to predict the full scope of the relief measures needed because of the uncontrolled spread of the virus across the country that shows no sign of slowing down. Josh Bivens said, obviously, the big danger to everything in the next couple of months is the coronavirus. He added, and we cannot spend enough money in effort to contain that.
علي حبه جنة قسيم النار والجنة وصي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wassalatu wassalamu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the qualities of the pious people based on the Sermon 184 in Nahjul Balagha, which is also known as the Sermon of the Pious People, or the Khutbatul Muttaqeen. And we reach this phrase where Imam Ali alayhi salam was talking about the importance of the togetherness of actions and speech. It shouldn't be that a person speaks something that he does not act in accordance to it. And this is how a pious person is in reality. And of course, we ended and we exhausted that discussion in the previous session. And now we come to the next phrase where Imam Ali alayhi salam says, تراه قريبا أمله قليلا زلله. You see that his hopes are realistic. His hopes are nearby. He doesn't have far-fetched, long hopes, futile hopes. They are realistic and close by hopes. They are nearby. His hopes are near. They are not far. Of course, we will discuss, inshallah, in this particular session, what is meant by Qareebul Amal.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, when it comes to one of the qualities of the pious people, that quality is that a pious person is one whose hopes are not far-fetched, long, and they are very realistic, clear, and reachable hopes. They are hopes that are reachable, that are realistic and clear. قَرِيبٌ أَمَلُهُ. This is the opposite of something called طَوِيلًا أَمَلُهُ or طُولُ الْأَمَلُ. There is something called قُرْبُ الْأَمَلُ and there is something called another thing which is called طُولُ الْأَمَلُ. طُولُ الْأَمَلُ is severely discouraged in the Sharia of Islam and in the moral culture of Islam. طُولُ الْأَمَلُ basically means to have long hopes, far-fetched hopes, and unrealistic hopes. And these are of two types. Sometimes a person hopes to achieve something that is against the Sharia. Okay. For example, he wants to, you know, he wishes to do things like he wants to be the richest person in the world with all the wealth of the world. Right? And of course, he doesn't care how he achieves it. He just wants that. Now, this is achieving something, but that thing itself is not a very good thing. It's a bad thing. Sometimes it can be an unlawful thing. For example, a person makes up long, long procedures and has different thoughts about, for example, marrying someone or, you know, getting in touch with a certain person of the opposite gender. Okay. Of course, that person is someone who is not related to someone, let's say he wants to get in touch with for certain reasons, but that is something unlawful according to the Sharia. He has to either get married to someone who is unmarried or someone who wishes to get married to him. But if a person builds up all these thoughts and hopes of achieving that person, for example, that person of the opposite gender, while, for example, that woman is married, that of course is a very futile hope. It's a long hope. We call it tulul amal, which is destructive.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, when it comes to long hopes, one of the examples is to hope for something which is unlawful. Sometimes it is hoping for something which is lawful, which is good, but without being prepared, without having any practical steps taken in the direction of what you hope. So, for example, someone hopes that he becomes the biggest scientist in the world. Right? It is not bad to have these hopes. It is good. But this will become a long hope a far-fetched hope, a futile hope, if he does not take steps towards achieving that aim and goal. And this can be destructive to the soul, to the heart, because a person will continue to have that hope in his mind, and the very thought of it will make him happy without really him achieving that goal. And this is one of the things that is extremely discouraged, and it is very dangerous. On the other hand, a pious person is one whose hopes are realistic and they are true. So first of all, he plans to achieve those hopes and aims. His aims are very lofty, they can be very high. He can aim to be the greatest of scientists, or he can be the best of philanthropists, let's say, and let's say one of the most powerful politicians in the world. But he takes steps to achieve those aims and objectives. As such, his hopes are near. Why do we say his hopes are near? Is because he has taken some steps, and because of the steps he has taken, that hope is close by. It's almost achievable. You see, it is almost achievable. It is close to achievement. But a person who doesn't act in accordance to his hopes, he just hopes that I will become this and I will become that, but doesn't take steps, then that hope is unachievable. It's very far from achievement. He needs to take those steps first to be able to achieve. That's why it is called Tulul Amal. That means a long hope, a far-fetched hope. And of course, it can be, as I said previously, it can be dangerous, because it can be like a drug which a person uses and makes him feel good, but really doesn't make him achieve anything in life. Let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that just like the pious people, we are able to perform our actions in such a way that what we want to achieve becomes nearby, and our hopes become ones which are near and close by. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي ربا.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
On the news line.
Top Iraqi military officials, including Defense Minister Lieutenant General Juma Anatsadun Khattab, along with the Navy, Air Force, and Air Defense commanders, have visited the Iranian capital Tehran and met with high-ranking officials there. Chairman of the Chiefs of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, Major General Mohammad Bagheri, said the two sides discussed ways to reinforce defense and military cooperation. Bagheri further noted that during his meeting with the Iraqi defense minister, the two sides exchanged views on issues related to defense industry and security of the two countries' common borders, as well as bilateral cooperation and joint military exercises. The Iranian officials stressed the significance of boosting defense cooperation between the two neighbors, as the United States is after redeploying terrorists in the region.
A resurgence of terrorism in the region will help the United States to maintain its influence and to even infiltrate more than before in the region. And who is milking terrorist groups in the region in order to impose its will, in order to occupy, plunder, and change regimes?
The Iraqi defense chief also held talks with Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, on bilateral, regional, and international developments. Shamkhani said the U.S. objective is to create rifts and conflicts among regional states in West Asia, underlining the need for the regional countries to exercise vigilance against the sinister plot. Khattab, for his part, hailed Tehran's support and assistance for his country in repelling terrorism and stressed expanding bilateral relations, especially in military and security sectors. Calls for the ouster of foreign troops from the Iraqi soil strengthened following the U.S. assassination of top Iranian anti-terror commander Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and deputy head of Iraq's popular mobilization units Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis near the Baghdad airport earlier this year. Following the attack, Iraqi lawmakers unanimously approved a bill demanding the withdrawal of all foreign forces from the country. Numerous rallies and protests have also been held across the country since with the same demands. The latest such demonstration was held last week near Baghdad's high-security green zone, where government buildings and foreign missions, including the U.S. Embassy, are located.
By assassinating the Iranian and Iraqi anti-terror heroes who literally liberated Iraq and Syria from the terrors of ISIS, the United States was fighting against the fight on terrors. And how could they sell their weapons, warmongers in the United States sell their weapons and maintain their presence?
Washington has so far transferred several Iraqi military bases back to local forces, with senior U.S. military officials saying local forces are increasingly able to counter terrorism on their own. The head of the Pentagon's Central Command said earlier this year that the number of U.S. troops in West Asia, including Iraq and Syria, would most likely be reduced soon. The commander, however, said he expected U.S. and NATO forces to maintain a long-term presence in Iraq to both help what he called fighting terrorism and checking Iranian influence in the country.
People have suffered enough, and in fact, they have demanded the United States presence termination. I think if the Iraqi government believes that they have democracy, that they have a system that can translate public opinion into laws and normatives, they should facilitate what the Iraqi parliament has already ratified.
But what has prompted the United States to reduce its troops in the region? Some experts say Trump wants to deliver his 2016 campaign promise of bringing back American forces from abroad. But others believe that Washington is losing its footprint in West Asia as calls for expelling U.S. forces by regional nations have grown stronger than ever.
Not so long ago, the Prime Minister of Ethiopia was stood on the stage at the Nobel Hall in Oslo, receiving the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts in achieving peace and international cooperation in resolving the border dispute with neighbouring country, Eritrea. Move forward to today, and the Ethiopian Prime Minister is refusing to enter any form of dialogue over an ongoing ethnic conflict in the north of the country, with some allegations now suggesting that war crimes could be being committed in the region as the battle rages on between the Ethiopian military and the Tigray People's Liberation Front. The United Nations lead on human rights, Michelle Bachelet, has stated that the situation is spinning out of control, leading to heavy casualties, destruction, and mass displacement of people, something that the region is very much ill-equipped to cope with, leading to a potential humanitarian disaster. But for the Nobel Peace Prize winner, Ahmed Abiy, he's making very serious claims that the Tigray people are responsible for acts of treason and terrorism, something that has seen the conflict see the Ethiopian military step up their efforts in sending resources to the region to quash the notion. Yet it seems that the scale of the operation is causing disturbing reports emerging from the area, with witnesses claiming that they've seen Ethiopian forces bombing civilian areas, as well as ground operations that have seen shooting on the streets, as well as machete attacks. So what is the real source of this conflict, and why have tensions escalated into a full-blown civil war, in spite of pleas by the international arena to halt the fighting?
When the current Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed came to power in 2018, he decided that he was now going to eliminate this old structure, and he proposed a new party called the Prosperity Party, which would not be based on any nationality, not Tigrayan, not Oromo, not Amhara, etc. And the TPLF rebelled and didn't want their power challenged with this new structure.
What now remains to be seen is whether the fighting will cause the conflict to spill over into neighbouring countries, something that could lead to further issues in the region. Ethiopia is no stranger when it comes to seeing masses of people flee from its nation. The 1980s saw famine force hundreds of thousands of Ethiopians away from their homeland in search of food and water. And yet again today, the same dilemma is in force, yet this time with people fleeing conflict. Estimates have already placed over 14,500 people, half of whom are children, as fleeing the conflict zone, with many of them heading to Sudan, with aid agencies stating that more could follow as the situation becomes worse. With the tensions now spreading outside of the Tigray region in the form of an attack on an airport in the neighbouring state, the notion that refugees could start abandoning Ethiopia from other parts of the country could have a detrimental effect on the region and could draw in the presence of neighbouring countries into the fold. Yet as the conflict escalates and no sign of diplomacy is on the immediate horizon, the situation in and around the Horn of Africa could escalate into a regional war as neighbouring states and international actors form alliances and allegiances based on their own goals, setting off yet another disaster in a region that should instead be embracing a post-colonial peace.
Britain and the European Union face another fast-approaching deadline to conclude marathon talks on their future relationship. December 31st is looming, but the remaining differences are apparently still very significant. The two sides are trying to hammer out an agreement on their future ties that will include a crucial trade deal, security cooperation, and rules in areas like fishing access. The talks are tough, with each side pushing to get the other to make more concessions. Battered by the devastating impact of the coronavirus pandemic, businesses in Britain urgently need a trade agreement that would minimize disruption in January when the country officially exits the European trading system. But top EU officials are taking a tough line on Britain and are unwilling to budge. A summit of EU leaders on November 19th is widely seen as the final deadline for a draft deal. The situation has piled pressure on British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who was a key architect of Brexit. He seems to be scrambling to make trade deals with other nations like the United States to make the UK less dependent on a deal with the European bloc. He has used the possibility of clinching trade deals with other countries as a bargaining chip in talks with Brussels. Johnson wants to get the EU to believe that Britain can easily survive even if it leaves the bloc's trading system without a deal. He has long been pinning his hopes on a fast-track free trade deal with America. Boris Johnson was among the first world leaders to congratulate Joe Biden soon after media projections showed that he won the presidential race. Critics in Britain and the U.S. have dismissed this as insincere, as members of Johnson's cabinet and Tory lawmakers had openly supported the re-election of the incumbent president. Things will probably be a lot different if Biden takes office in January. Unlike Trump, Biden has made it clear that the withdrawal agreement, which set the stage for Britain's formal departure from the European Union, must be respected. This means Biden doesn't like a no-deal Brexit at all. Meanwhile, Biden speaks very proudly of his Irish roots. He has made it clear that the 1998 U.S. broker Good Friday peace deal for Northern Ireland must never be violated. That, some believe, is a warning against a bill pushed by Johnson that would violate parts of the EU divorce agreement governing the border with Ireland. Biden's stance may weaken Johnson's position in talks with Brussels.
And we've got a much closer relationship between the Democratic Party and Brussels. So this is going to be bad for Britain, no doubt about it, when it comes into next year. But don't forget, this deal has got to be signed by the end of 2020. And so Trump is still going to be president at that point. When the negotiations are going down the line, that's one of the reasons why I think the European Union will be doing everything it can to make sure there is no deal at the end of the year.
Top EU negotiators know all too well that a balance is changing. The British Premier now has to perform a delicate balancing act. He has to come up with a way to pressure Brussels that does not antagonize Biden. Johnson faces a mammoth task. Is he up to the job? The British Premier faces a race against time, as any agreement has to be ratified by the European and British parliaments before the looming deadline.
The beautiful game, as they call it, was supposed to bring people from around the world together, enabling nations and races to mix on the field, playing a sport loved by all. Yet, it seems in England, the beautiful game has an ugly side. Not from the fouls committed by the players during the match, but from the very top of the governing body ruling the sport, the FA. The chief of the English Football Association, which is one of the world's oldest and most respected, has resigned after a storm ensued following the use of language used by the boss when describing black players making their living in the English leagues. Greg Clark was forced to apologise after he used the word coloured to describe black players, a term that's derogatory in nature and highly offensive. Furthermore, he also used other discriminatory slurs against other minorities in the sport, including women. One would have imagined that the UK of all nations would have taken note of the protests sparked by the murder of George Floyd in the US, with the protests even hitting the streets of the UK in the process. Yet it seems that the banners, adverts and campaigns to stop racism in Britain are facing an impossible battle, in particular when the very highest echelons of authority are themselves racist. Football in particular is most interesting in England, with players taking to their knees before each match as a sign of respect to the Black Lives Matter protests. Yet, as one professional football describes, the only disease in the world right now that appears to be unbeatable is racism, with Raheem Sterling himself suffering horrific abuse on the pitch from racist fans. But the truth of the matter is simple. Britain has been pulling the wool over the eyes of many by claiming that racism doesn't exist in the country. However, this could not be further from the truth, as no matter how many television adverts portray mixed-race couples living together, or the government placing token black and ethnic minority ministers in seats, the fact is, Britain is racist to the core, from the top down. So how then can Britain truly put an end to this horrific discrimination, with this in mind?
It's certainly true that there have been a lot of efforts by governments, both Labour and Conservative, over the years to try to tackle the problem of racism, including in sport and especially in football. But as we saw in the case with Mr. Clark, who used a term to refer to black people, which these days is not acceptable, he very quickly was under pressure to resign and accepted that what he'd said was unacceptable. But what's happening is that in all parts of society and all companies, including sports companies, basically people are going through what's called unconscious bias training. In other words, they may not think they're racist, but they need to learn how to relate to people of different ethnicities and what sort of language to use so as not to be unintentionally racist in their behaviour.
Across the UK, the race divide is highlighted more than ever around the towns and cities of the country, with many of the poorest areas having large populations of black and ethnic minority residents living within their boundaries. This has sparked a subconsciously racist approach in the way that certain institutions deal with such minorities across Britain. For one, the police, who claim to be improving their diversity quotas, are one of the most racist institutions in the UK, with one ex-officer claiming that being a minority in the police means dealing with racism by one's own colleagues is a daily occurrence. With racism clearly an issue within police stations around Britain already being a major factor, things are even worse on the streets, with reports claiming that the Metropolitan Police in London, which is the UK's most diverse city, is more than four times more likely to use force on black people than on other races, hence cementing the point further. But such issues can be seen around the nation, with more favourable facilities being granted to white British people over ethnic minority races, ranging inequality at educational institutions, housing, medical care, social benefits, and fighting poverty, with the racism filtering top-down when it comes to how certain areas are dealt with. In spite of high-profile faces, such as Manchester United star Marcus Rashford, aiming to get the government to wake up and feed the disadvantaged proportions of the population, it's the case that the UK government and its range of institutions are simply picking and choosing who they help, based not on merit and need, but on race and social class.
When the first black and Asian immigrants came to Britain in the 1950s and 1960s, they did indeed take much of the low-paid work in the public transport sector, in factories, cleaning jobs and so on. And so the communities were much poorer. Since then, there has been greater social mobility though. We see black people and Asian people in as university professors, Mayor of London, several government ministers, though still there are a lot of BME people who are in the lower paid job.
In the limelight.
The Finance in Common Summit was the first global meeting of the vast family of institutions that intersect between finance and public policy, and was one of the largest international governance and finance gatherings in 2020 since the spread of the coronavirus pandemic. The organisers of the summit are heralding public development banks as a visible hand that can help mobilise and direct the finance we need for the future we want. Unfortunately, these institutions do not have a great track record, with significant documentation of their projects excluding directly affected communities and doing more harm. Development banks have repeatedly supported fossil fuel projects that have contributed to climate change, polluted ecosystems causing lung disease, and made people more vulnerable to the worst effects of COVID-19. They have also engaged in greenwashing, supporting fossil-free projects that take traditionally held lands without the consent of local communities and indigenous peoples, destroying the biodiverse ecosystems they have protected for generations. Stay with us for an article written by Siddharth Akali, an international lawyer who has been trained by local communities, indigenous governments and peoples in Canada, India and Nepal. The piece is titled "Global Summit of Development Banks Fails to Learn from Destructive Past." The article has been taken from the website of the Interpress Service. Stay with us for more of Siddharth Akali's article. Recently, 450 public development banks from around the world met for the Finance in Common Summit at the Paris Peace Forum. they gathered to discuss how they can direct their combined investments of over 2